You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And many, many thanks to Carl Frisch for filling in for me yesterday. And glad to be back. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson, apropos of this whole Cory Booker, Mitt Romney, blah-de-blah-de-blah-quack-quack-quack thing that's going on, which I want to talk about here. Jefferson said, "There is an artificial aristocracy founded on wealth and birth, without either virtue or talents. The artificial aristocracy is a mischievous ingredient in government, and provisions should be made to prevent its ascendancy, to prevent it from rising, as in rising to power. There is an artificialist aristocracy founded on wealth and birth without either virtue or talents." And that's what's going on here. This Cory Booker stepped in it big time. Okay, just to lay it out, you know, in a pretty straightforward fashion. And you know, nobody's really sure exactly why. Although his having taken several hundred thousand dollars in his political career from banksters and private equity firms and Bain Capital Partners probably has something to do with it. But it raises in my mind two questions, one, or three questions, really. One, does he even know what private equity really is? Vulture capitalism. We're going to explain that in a second. We're going to have, actually, Robert Reich is going to explain it in just a second. Number two, did he say what he said? And I'll play the clip for you in a moment, because he was worried about the people who have, you know, in part funded him. And number three, are progressives too quick to form a circular firing squad? Because here's a guy who's, you know, his political career goes back a decade. He's a good progressive. He's done great work. He's been on this program a couple of times. I don't have, you know, I don't know him personally. I have no obligation to him or opposition to him either. But I think this is a legitimate question. Many of the people who have donated money, who work at Bain Capital or who are affiliated with the private equity industry or who are banksters who have donated money to Cory Booker's campaign, probably are good progressives, or they're playing both sides of the road, but I can guarantee you they've probably given money to a lot of other progressives as well. And they've certainly given money to the Obama campaign. So are we being a little too quick to form the circular firing squad? Or is this really a legitimate concern? And if it is a legitimate concern that Cory Booker, the progressive mayor of Newark, came out and defended private, actually let's just play that clip to get the, you know, what it is we're talking about on the table. This was, you know, from one of the weekend shows here. I think this was Meet the Press, wasn't it? Yeah, this is from Meet the Press on Sunday. I don't watch the program anymore, so I have to do it. I have to catch the clips afterwards. Here's Cory Booker.
I have to just say, from a very personal level, I'm not about to sit here and indict private equity. It's, to me, it's just this, we're getting to a ridiculous point in America, especially that I know I live in a state where pension funds, unions, and other people are investing in companies like Bain Capital. If you look at the totality of Bain Capital's record, they've done a lot to support businesses, to grow businesses, and this, to me, I'm very uncomfortable.
Okay, so I would say that in all probability, number one, Cory Booker doesn't have an understanding of how vulture capitalism, venture capitalism works. Because it doesn't work the way it's not venture capitalism, this is private equity. Private equity, which is what Bain Financial is, which used to be called M&A firms or vulture capitalism. There used to be a lot of names for them, and they all decided to change their name to private equity. Private equity, or vulture capitalism, is a very different thing than the old-fashioned venture capitalism. The old-fashioned venture capitalism was, You know, some rich guy sitting on a pile of money. You want to start a business. You go to him and you say, hey, I got this great idea for a business. I'd like to start it. Will you invest $1 million in my company? The venture capitalist says, sure, give me 20% in exchange for my investment and you work out a deal. And in fact, I can tell you, I've been through this. When we started the travel agency in Atlanta back in 1983, there were three partners, me, a friend of mine who owned another travel agency, and a fellow who owned a big electronics company out outside of Atlanta, who was a venture capitalist. He just made an investment. And 3 years later, when we sold the company, he saw a huge return on his investment. So that's where, somebody puts their own money at risk. Now, here's Robert Reich explaining how vulture capitalism, a.k.a. private equity, works.
Let me explain the magic of private equity in 8 simple steps. Step 1, partners in private equity firms don't risk their own money. They get other people to give them money to invest. Step 2, they use this money to buy up companies they think they can squeeze higher profits from. Step 3, they squeeze out higher profits by cutting the company's costs. And for most companies, the biggest cost is payrolls. So private equity managers typically reduce payrolls by firing workers and or cutting other workers' wages and their health and pension benefits. Step 4, they also use the company as collateral to borrow a pile of money from banks. And since interest payments on this debt are deductible from company income, presto, the company shows even bigger profits. Step 5, they get the company to issue a special dividend to repay the original investors. So now everything else is gravy. Step 6, then they sell the company for much more than they bought it for because, hey, it's more profitable. Step 7, they pocket 20% of the gains from the sale. And finally, step 8, because the tax law treats these earnings as capital gains, they pay only a 15% tax on them.
Yeah, and there you go. And then Robert Reich goes on to say, and by the way, who gets stuck with the bill? When these companies, because they, these private equity firms like Bain Capital, when they wring a company out, when they start laying off employees, when they start cutting back on benefits, who picks up the slack? Who's paying the unemployment benefits? We are. Who's paying for the Medicare for these people? We are the Medicaid. We are. Who is picking up the tax bill that they're no longer paying because they just got by loading this company up with millions and millions of dollars in debt, they now have this giant tax deduction called interest expense. And so the taxable income of the company, the company gets this giant tax break. Who makes that up? We do. And when they sell it, and people like Mitt Romney pay a maximum 15% income tax, last year he paid 14% and change, who makes up the difference? Because our government really needs all of us to be paying, at least into the upper income brackets, be paying around 30-35%. It worked during Clinton's administration. So who makes up the difference? We do. So you and I are all paying the extra taxes so that Mitt Romney can make all his money and other people like Bain. And this is why I think that Cory Booker just doesn't understand how private equity, a.k.a. vulture capitalism, works. Because once you understand how it works, and maybe there should be a major campaign to try and educate every American to how Mitt Romney made his money and how Bain Capital makes their money. Because once you understand how it works, you get it. It's a giant con job. These guys are con artists.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, are progressives too quick to form the circular firing squad, or did Cory Booker sell out? Your thoughts after this. But Mitt Romney sure is. Welcome back. So this is the question. Cory Booker actually in many ways is just kind of a surrogate for this whole larger discussion, which is, should private equity, vulture capitalism, be illegal like it was before the Reagan presidency? I mean, there was no such thing before Reagan. And then they changed the rules and tweaked this tax code and tweaked that tax code. And most importantly, made it possible to buy a company and then have that company borrow money in its own name, not in your name, even though you now own the company. So you don't get your hands dirty with debt. And if the company goes down in flames, it goes bankrupt, but you don't. Right? That level of insulation that has allowed Bain Capital to make billions of dollars. Mitt Romney's worth $250 million because of Bain Capital. And it's all based on loopholes in the law. It should all be against the law. And it's going to be really interesting to see, because the president, by raising this issue, is essentially litigating those parts of the tax code that make legal or illegal venture capital. Excuse me, not venture capital, private equity. See, this is the thing. Even I am mixing these things up, and the average American has no idea what the distinction is between the two. That private equity and venture capital are completely different things. Marcy in Long Island, New York. Hey, Marcy, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Mr. Hartman. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for explaining this so well. I wish that explain it. The free enterprise is free for who? I am very glad you brought this out today. I just had to call. It seems like a can of worms has been opened up.
Yes, hugely,
and
back during the Reagan administration.
Who gets holding the bag all the time?
Us.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So I
just heard you explaining it, and I wish that the Times or the, CNN or somebody would put this out there.
Yeah. Well, so far nobody has. Although MoveOn did today, the video that we played, that you heard the audio of Robert Reich explaining how private equity works.
I just missed it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it's Marcy, thank you very much for the call. It's very simple, straightforward process. Basically, you've got a company that's got 20, 30, 50 employees, 100 employees, whatever. Say you got a company with 100 employees that's worth $1 million, just to pull numbers out of the air, and it's just doing, it's just going along. And you go to the owners of that company, you say, we'd like to buy your company. And they say, okay, fine, we'll take the $1 million and run. So you buy the company for $1 million. So actually, first, you go to a bank, and you say, we'd like $1 million loan, and this company is the collateral for the loan. So the bank gives you the money, you buy the company, but the debt is associated with the company. Now, once the company has the debt, All the repayments that it's making to the bank include interest. Now, interest is tax deductible. So if that $1 million company was spinning off, say, $100,000 a year in profits before and was paying taxes on all that $100,000, now they're having to pay $60,000, $70,000 a year in interest, which reduces their taxes. So now instead of $100,000 in profit, they're showing $160,000 in profit. Follow this? In other words, they just got a giant tax break because they have debt. Now, this is a bizarre thing that's in the tax code that goes way, way back. I mean, this goes back to the 1940s, maybe before that, I believe, though, it was the 40s or the 50s, that we would make interest payments deductible to corporations because we wanted to encourage them to borrow from the banks to make the banks more profitable. So the bankers lobbied for this. And then once you own the company, what do? You lay off 20% of the workers, and everybody else, you strip them of their health insurance benefits and any other benefits they may have, and presto, the company's even more profitable. Now your balance sheet's looking really good. Then you sell the company, you make a profit on it, or you bankrupt the company and you take the pension fund and you make a profit on it. And that money that you end up with, you pay a maximum 15% income tax on because it's called capital gains. You and I make the difference. Paul, listening on AM 760 in Denver. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I think you're missing the main point of the Robert Reich's 8 point. What he didn't put in there was, a company doesn't need capital unless it's in trouble, unless it's going out of business.
That's correct. Bain Capital only buys companies, or typically private equity companies only buy companies that are already doing fine.
Yeah, but that's the point. That's why Bain Capital is a service to this country and companies like them.
You have a service?
Who do you go to? Luigi at the end of the corner to get your money? You have to go to companies when you're in trouble.
Nice try with the Republican talking points, but you are completely missing the point. When Bain Capital, for example, bought Clear Channel, and I was working in Portland at a Clear Channel radio station, they dumped that company with an enormous amount of debt. The company wasn't in trouble to begin with. It was spinning off all kinds of profits. They buy the company, squeeze the employees out all of a sudden, layoffs all across the company. I mean, what Mitt Romney and Bain Capital do is not venture capital. And if a company is in trouble, well, they could go to the bank, they can declare bankruptcy. There's a lot of remedies that they have. But this is not what these guys do. They don't save failing companies. They take existing companies that are doing just fine, thank you very much, and squeeze all the money, all the employees, all the employee benefits out, lay off as many people as possible, throw people into the streets, pay a maximum 15% tax on the profits that they make so that you and I have to pay the rest. You and I have to pay the unemployment benefits. You and I have to pay for the health care for these people who are now below the poverty level because they're broke and unemployed, or they're making $10 an hour working at Staples. You and I are the ones who have to pick up the slack because the guy who used to be working in a steel mill is delivering pizzas for Domino's. Right? You and I are the ones who pick up the balance in that. You and I are the ones who made Mitt Romney into a multi-hundred millionaire. It's wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Private equity should be illegal. But, you know, nobody has addressed the issue of Cory Booker. We'll get back to that. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This whole Cory Booker thing, I think, is frankly... Well, here, the president had this clip number two, Shane. Here's what the president had to say about Bain Capital.
My opponent, Governor Romney, his main calling card for why he thinks he should be president is his business experience. Yeah, he's not going out there touting his experience in Massachusetts. He's saying, I'm a business guy and I know how to fix it, and this is his business. And when you're president, as opposed to the head of a private equity firm, then your job is not simply to maximize profits.
No, in fact, it goes beyond that. When you're president, your job is to make sure that the infrastructure which allows for business is functioning. And this is what the Republicans are trying to tear down, which doesn't make any sense unless they're just trying to crash the economy so that Obama will look bad so that they can get Romney in. Because the Supreme Court is at stake. And they want to keep Citizens United. They want to keep their power. They want to keep this oligarchy, this plutocracy going. I mean, this is, in my opinion, a very, very straightforward thing. John in Troy, Michigan. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think you forgot one thing. When Bain bankrupted these companies had vendors. Suppliers.
Right.
And a lot of these suppliers, these vendors, only received like 1%
right.
of what was owed to them. So, you know, apparently, you know, the Romney has no problem even screwing his fellow Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Bain had already taken the money and run, and then they bankrupt the company, and you're right, all the vendors get screwed. You're absolutely right. Excellent point.
Right.
Thank you.
And the taxpayers, we have to pay for the pension fund. So these people will end up with maybe 30%, maybe 40% at the most for their pension.
Of their pension,
so
yeah.
We're on the hook for that.
Yes,
like
and again, you can go back to the Reagan administration when it was, you know, made legal to commingle pension funds and general funds. Before that, pension funds had to be in a separate lockbox so that if the company went down in flames, the employees were covered. But, you know, right. that got blown up in the 1980s, too, much to the advantage of Bain Capital. John, thanks a lot for the call. Carol in Eagan, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. A couple of points. I don't know if you've seen this, that YouTube thing with this Nick Hanauer who spoke before Ted about how he's a billionaire. He's not private equity. He's the opposite. He's the venture capitalist who gives people money to invest And he made this speech.
Right. They're sometimes referred to as angel investors.
Pardon?
They're sometimes referred to as angel investors. They're the people who invest and thus companies start. It's like the guy who renounced his U.S. citizenship to move to Singapore because he's making $3 billion on the the Facebook IPO. He put in $15,000, which is what started the whole started Facebook.
Right, and this Nick Hanauer he sounded like you because people create jobs. The middle class is what creates jobs. I don't create jobs, and Mitt Romney doesn't create jobs. But he gave a really good speech. He's also written a book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think every state, like I'm from Minnesota, and I think every state would have an example of this. Northwest Airlines, which no longer exists, in the 80s was bought up, and Northwest Airlines was a cash cow because the guy that ran it was as tight with the buck as anybody. They owned all their bases all over the world, and Al Checkey and Gary Wilson came in, and they leveraged that company to the hilt.
Right.
They took millions out of the state.
Yeah. Now, let me just, if I may, just for people who don't know what we're talking about, when this is, again, during the Reagan administration, the first couple of years of the Reagan administration, all of a sudden there was this explosion of mergers and acquisitions and leveraged buyouts, LBOs. And the companies that did these LBOs were referred to as LBO firms or LBO artists. And that got a really bad name, so they changed their name from LBO, leveraged buyout, to private equity, which is what Bain Capital calls itself. But the word leverage, what that means is that they borrow the money from somebody else. In other words, somebody else's money is the lever that they're using to pry this company out of its current ownership and put it into their pocket. Back to you.
And so they took millions out of the state. Then they were about to go belly up, and the state bailed them out with the promise that they would build a repair facility in the northern part of Minnesota that would employ X hundreds of people. And, of course, you know what happened, don't you? They sold the company, and the repair facility was never built. And I'll bet in every single state in the United States, they can find an example of this very type thing. And Northwest no longer exists. It's now part of Delta.
Yeah. There you go. And thank you very much, Carol. Well said and very clearly stated. Rob in Mount Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, what's up?
I don't know. It's where, I really enjoy your program and listen to you for years, but you've got the Capitol right behind your head there. And the whole thing is, don't you think you ought to have a picture of the building right across the street as far as
the Supreme Court,
Constitution Avenue, as far as where they where all the lobbyists have their their offices and stuff like that. It's where they are the ones that are actually controlling our future, when you really come right down to it.
Yeah, and who made that possible?
What's that?
You know who made that possible for lobbyists to control the destiny of this country?
I don't know.
The Supreme Court.
Please inform me.
The Supreme Court. In 74 in Buckley versus Vallejo. You can go back to 1886 if you want, Santa Clara County. But there have been a series of decisions, and thank you for the call, Robbie. Excellent point. The series of decisions made by the Supreme Court that said that increasingly, over time, increasingly building this doctrine that the Supreme Court created out of thin air. No Congress ever voted for this, to say that money is not property, that it's somehow magically speech and thus protected by the First Amendment. No Congress ever voted to say corporations aren't legal abstractions, they're people. No Congress ever voted for this. No president ever recommended this. In fact, if anything, the opposite. The Supreme Court came up with this all on its own, created this doctrine out of thin air, and that is the doctrine that says that lobbyists have free speech rights. And one of those big free speech rights is money. This is just really, really wrong. Dan in Warren, Michigan. Hey, Dan, what's up?
I recommend your show to people all the time. It's a great show. Here's my question. Your explanation of venture capital and vulture capital is really great, but what I don't understand is how do they initially take the purchase money and transfer it from their own loan to a company loan? You keep saying, well, they borrow against the company, but they don't own it yet.
Right.
I don't understand that step in the process.
I can't say that I do either. I just know that it happens, right? How it's done legally, what the legal terms are, or how it's done with regard to the tax code, never having been involved in it, I can't explain. What I can say with absolute certainty is that, as Robert Reich, the former Treasury Secretary and a professor of economics, he really knows this stuff, as Robert Reich said, well, in fact, maybe we could just drop like 20 seconds or so into that clip and hear Robert Reich explain it. Let's see. Here, hang on just a second.
Let me explain the magic of private equity in 8 simple steps. Step 1. Partners in private equity firms don't risk their own money. They get other people to give them money to invest. Step 2. They use this money to buy up companies they think they can squeeze higher profits from. Step 3. They squeeze out higher profits by cutting the company's costs. And for most companies, the biggest cost is payrolls. So private equity managers typically reduce payrolls by firing workers and or cutting other workers' wages and their health and pension benefits. Step 4. They also use the company as collateral to borrow a pile of money from banks. And since interest payments on this debt are deductible from company income, presto, the company shows even bigger profits.
Okay, so let's just stop right there. So it sounds to me like what he's saying is they acquire the company, and then the company goes to the bank and says, loan me the money.
I gotcha.
But, you know, there may be like a 15-second interval.
Yeah.
Right? But and they may have some money at risk for 15 seconds. But again, as I said, I'm not a private equity guy. I'm an old-fashioned, free enterprise guy. So I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good one. Maybe somebody will call in who does know. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Jamie in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Hey, Jamie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I'd like to acknowledge that the head of the NRC, the only sane member, has resigned. I think
yes, he did.
He deserves some time.
On the other hand, I think he was driven out.
Deserves some media time. Anyway, I would like to find out who is profiting from the Republicans creating the climate that has our credit ratings fall.
The banksters profit.
Last time they wouldn't.
I can answer that question really. I can answer that question really quickly and really simply for you, Jamie. The banksters can still borrow. The big banks can still borrow through the Fed Treasury window or the Fed window for a fraction of 1%. But as interest rates go up, their borrowing costs don't go up. But the amount of money that they can charge when they loan money out to other people or other companies, that does go up. So the banks become more profitable when the credit rating of the United States goes down because it tends to lead toward higher interest rates overall. And those higher interest rates mean that the banks become more profitable. So that's the answer to your question, Jamie. With the Republicans crashing the U.S. government and U.S. credit rating, so S&P downgraded us, who makes money on that? Banksters, especially the big banks on Wall Street who can borrow money directly through the Fed.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Still, nobody's brought up Cory Booker. I find this fascinating. Are progressives too quick to form a circular firing squad? But if you try sometimes, you get what you need, right? What we need is one more reasonable voice on the United States Supreme Court, because they are now more powerful than the president or Congress, and that person will probably be appointed in the next 4 years, because you have 4 members of the U.S. Supreme Court who are older than 70 years old. And that, in my opinion, is what this presidential election is all about, and it's why the Republicans are fighting so hard. It's why the big corporations are fighting so hard, because they know if they can get a couple of more right-wing wackadoodles on the Supreme Court and reinvent a Supreme Court that looks like it did in 1933, that they'll be able to start striking down things that Franklin Roosevelt passed, like Social Security, or that Lyndon Johnson passed, like Medicare, as unconstitutional. Child labor laws that were passed during Teddy Roosevelt's administration. We can knock, and they were struck down by the Supreme Court, by the way, back in the day. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's up?
I want to talk more about Cory Booker, and you asked, are progressives quick to form the circular firing squad? And in my opinion, Booker's the one who's actually who actually did the firing. You know, I think you said maybe he was pandering, and if so, then he got carried away. You know, his comments were way over the top, and it undermines the Obama campaign. And whatever, you know, you might think of the ad in question or whether you thought it was biased or what, you know, he used the term nauseating, and it certainly was not nauseating. What it was you had testimonials from former employees of a company that Bain took over, and that's not nauseating. You know, you could make biased charges or whatever. And
yeah. Well, it's nauseating that Bain was able to do that. But I totally agree with you. And in fact, let me offer a hypothesis. Thanks for the call, Dan. Let me offer a hypothesis here about what happened. What Cory Booker did is he offered a false equivalency. He said that basically the president holding Romney guilty for Bain, for the sins of Bain, which he helped start and which he ran, is equivalent to holding Obama guilty of the perceived sins of Reverend Wright. Now, if you actually read Reverend Wright's sermon in which he uses the phrase that God will damn America, if you actually read that sermon, you discover that it's actually a pretty stand-up sermon. I mean, it's tough love, but it's pretty solid. But, you know, that requires a little nuance, and it requires reading five or six sentences at least, or a couple of paragraphs, and the news media can't handle it. Here's what I think happened. Cory Booker went on Meet the Press. Meet the Press is all about false equivalence. The media has this narrative that they constantly play, which is, oh, well, you think the Republicans are bad, the Democrats do the same thing. And Cory Booker, hanging out with David Gregory and all these other people in the news media who are constantly promoting this phony false equivalency argument, just kind of, you know, he drank the Kool-Aid. And then, as soon as he got off the air, of course, he realized he drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, it's okay for David Gregory to say those things, but what, a guy who's sitting there as a surrogate for the president, who's supposed to be in favor of President Obama being president, saying, I don't think so. Joel in Chicago. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Hi, I was just calling about what a leveraged buyout is. And my understanding was always that when a company or investors buy a company through the leveraged buyout process, they're essentially getting a bank to value the company and provide a substantial loan for them and possibly some other equity to purchase the company. So they don't actually have the money to buy all the shares or the business.
That's correct. They use other people's money. It's usually a bank, but it's not always. They use other people's money to buy the business, and thus the word leveraged.
Right. So they buy the company initially, often with a huge amount of debt going to that company.
That's correct.
And a recent example is Sam Zell buying the Tribune Corporation for just far more amount of money than they could possibly generate to pay back, putting that whole, you know, media industry in a bankruptcy situation almost from the very beginning of that deal.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know the details of that, but, if it was a private equity deal or a leveraged buyout, as they used to be called, then, yeah, that's how it works.
It was definitely a leveraged buyout with, you know, some equity, but it was a huge loan, used to purchase the media corporation that was just way overvaluing the company.
Yeah, not a good thing for our democracy, but it is a good thing for rich guys who have good connections with banksters. Michael in Boston. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, thank you for calling. I mean, Mr. Hartman. Can companies write off the full interest, as you were saying?
Yeah, because they end up with the full debt. The company is responsible for the debt.
So if Mr. Romney says that corporations are people, why can't I write off the full amount of my student loans every year?
Actually, I think that, you know, there's different rules for corporations than there are for human beings. You can't call that interest a business expense unless it is, or functionally the equivalent of a business expense, unless it's a home mortgage interest deduction. The interest you pay on your home mortgage you can deduct because they want to encourage people to have mortgages. But the interest, it used to be that all, you know, credit card interest you could deduct. I mean, back during the Nixon administration, I think it was in the 70s, it might have been in the 80s, it was either Carter or Reagan, during one of those two administrations, they eliminated or did away with the ability to deduct credit card interest and other kinds of interest and just narrowed it down to only home mortgages. I think that was during the Reagan administration. But, you know, yeah, I get the irony of what you're pointing out is that, you know, there's different rules for corporations than from human beings, and yet the Supreme Court continues to insist corporations are people and, you know, et cetera. Right?
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Okay.
Appreciate
cool.
it. Thank
you. Thanks a lot for the call. We have just a few seconds here before we have to wrap up this first hour, so let me just make the point again. What Mitt Romney's doing is not venture capital. It's vulture capital, which is also known as leveraged buyouts, and the LBO industry changed its name to private equity because that sounds fancier, it sounds more elegant, it sounds less disgusting, and everybody in America was horrified by the LBO activities. Now everybody in America is getting to be familiar with private equity and discovering, hey, it's leveraged buyout in drag, right? It's just leveraged buyout wearing a dress. It's leveraged buyout, you know, dressed up differently. And it's still leveraged buyouts. And Cory Booker made the mistake of putting his foot in the middle of this one. I have a feeling, hopefully this will blow over. He's a decent guy. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Amazing piece in the New York Times today. They're reporting on a new campaign ad coming out this week by a Republican super PAC that's going after Obama. It's Karl Rove's super PAC. The ad is the centerpiece of a $25 million advertising campaign in 10 swing states funded by Karl Rove's corporate super PAC and produced by Larry McCarthy. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's because he's the guy behind the Willie Horton ads that sunk Michael Dukakis in 1988. The New York Times explains how it works, writing, quote, "Behind the story of the ad's creation rests one of the greatest challenges for Republicans in this election, how to develop a powerful line of attack against a president who remains well-liked, even by people who are considering voting against him." So to make this ad, end of quote. So to make this ad, Republican strategists took information from 18 different focus groups across a whole bunch of key states, all the way from Florida through Ohio, all the way out to Colorado. And what they found is that when they focus grouped attack ads against President Obama's integrity or character, it turned off voters because the president is basically well-liked by most Americans. In fact, the president of Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS Super PAC said, quote, "Voters are not interested in being told they made a horrible mistake. The disappointment they're now experiencing has to be handled carefully," end quote. So to handle it carefully, the ad, this ad that the Republicans are rolling out this week, which is entitled Basketball, features an actress portraying a woman who voted for President Obama 4 years ago and actually still likes him. As the actress says, "I supported President Obama because he spoke so beautifully. He promised change." Then she pivots, saying, "But things changed for the worse." She then tells a fictionalized but fairly common story about her family's financial problems, about how her children, unable to find a job after college, have moved back in with her, how she can't afford to retire. She basically speaks to the very same problems that many Americans are having. And even though the economy's gotten better with more than 4 million jobs created under Obama since the economic freefall was stopped in 2009, there are still millions and millions of Americans who've been left behind. Millions of Americans who desperately needed the president to take bold action and were left on their own when the president was only able to get a modest stimulus through Congress because of Republican opposition. Of course, the ad doesn't mention that Republicans have blocked more than 50 pieces of legislation that would have improved the economy over the past 3 years. Instead, it makes the argument that the buck stops with the president, that he's the one to blame for the ongoing struggle many Americans are feeling. It's these people, hurting working class people, who haven't been following politics carefully enough to know that it was really the Republicans in Congress who prevented the levels of economic recovery we really needed. It's those people who Republicans are targeting with this new ad. But despite the truth, which is that President Obama has disappointed a lot of Americans by going Bill Clinton instead of FDR in 2009, we all have to remember just how high the stakes are in this election. Hanging in the balance is the Supreme Court, which on which four justices are over 70 years old. The next president will change the makeup of the high court, and you can bet that if it's Mitt Romney, then we'll have even more right-wingers on the bench who could declare everything from food stamps to unemployment insurance to even Medicare as unconstitutional. At stake this election is the survival of the middle class, which President Obama perhaps hasn't done enough to protect, but which Mitt Romney would completely eviscerate, rolling back protections for labor unions, support for college students, relief for homeowners. At stake is our nation's standing in the world. With President Obama ending the war in Iraq, beginning the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan, and what does Mitt Romney want to do? Oh, yeah, bomb, bomb, bomb Iran. Yeah, oh, yeah. There's so much at stake in this election. And I, you know, while I would be leading a parade of those disappointed in the president for choosing to be Bill Clinton instead of FDR 3 years ago, I genuinely fear what will happen if Mitt Romney becomes president. This ad that Karl Rove is going to be rolling out this week across the nation is a brilliant study in the use of psychology and half-truths to win an election. The day President Obama was sworn in, Mitch McConnell, Republican Senate leader, declared that his first mission over the next 4 years would be to make Obama a one-term president. And McConnell has done an absolutely brilliant job of helping to bring that to a possible reality by having Republicans filibuster every single piece of good and useful legislation that would put Americans back to work. And now Karl Rove wants you to forget the role that he and George W. Bush played in crashing the economy, starting two illegal wars and throwing the government into red with a massive tax cut for rich people. Rove wants us all to forget that the day George W. Bush came into office, the deficit was zero. The debt was beginning to decline. That Bush himself pointed out in his first State of the Union address that by continuing Clinton's policies, he would pay off the entire national debt within 10 years. Here's George Bush in 2001.
The budget has funded a responsible increase in our ongoing operations. It has funded our nation's important priorities. It has protected Social Security and Medicare. And our surpluses are big enough that there is still money left over.
That's the Clinton surplus.
Many of you have talked about the need to pay down our national debt. I listened, and I agree.
Now, catch this whopper that's coming. He's talking about the Clinton surplus, how he's going to use it.
We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years.
You get that? $2 trillion he's going to pay down? That was pretty much all that he could pay down, because the rest of it was the Social Security Trust Fund.
At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire.
Because you can't retire the Social Security debt, because that's...
That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history.
So Karl Rove wants us all to forget that he was the architect. That was his title. You know, sometimes, in fact, there's a book about Karl Rove called The Architect. He referred to himself as the architect. Bush, of course, referred to him as Turd Blossom, but that's a whole other thing. He was the architect of the Bush presidency who ran America into the ditch. And Karl Rove instead wants average Americans to blame President Obama that he hasn't yet completely fixed the Republican Great Depression that George W. Bush left us. He's hoping, Karl Rove is hoping, that we'll all forget that George W. Bush stood up there in front of Congress in 2001 in the State of the Union address in, I believe it was in March of 2001, and said, I'm putting a budget on the table. You know, Clinton had this huge surplus when he left. Bush inherited a surplus. And the national debt when Bush became president was only in the neighborhood of $5, $6 trillion. And there was $3 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund, which you can't pay off. You wouldn't want to pay off. That's where Social Security parked its money. I mean, you want the government to continue paying interest to Social Security so it grows, right? So all you could pay off is a couple trillion dollars. And George W. Bush said, I'm going to come into office and I'm going to pay all of this off because we've got this surplus. And then he went insane. And he gave us two unpaid for wars that cost us $1 trillion each. He gave us Medicare Part D, which said that the Medicare administration cannot negotiate for lower prices with the pharmaceutical companies. They have to pay full retail and no provision to pay for it. Put it on the credit card. And he did this massive tax cut for millionaires and billionaires, people making money like Mitt Romney does, and put that on the credit card. And then he ran the economy into the ditch. He wants you to forget. I'm not forgetting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So just remember that day when George W. Bush said, I'm going to pay off the national, we're going to pay off all of the national debt that can be paid off. Right. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. I mean, what was it, about a year ago that you came up with that, Jacob? Occupy the media? It was in the real early days of the Occupy movement. Jacob comes out, writes this down, says, you got to. It took me a while to get it stuck in my brain, but it's a good one. It's a really good one. Cindy, click the button. Cindy in Waterville, Michigan.
Yes, hi, Tom.
What's up?
I haven't talked to you for a while. Used to talk to you when you were doing a little bit with the Chicago station on Fridays.
Yep.
And I'm glad that they're carrying you now. You know, you're talking about the venture capital, and I forgot that they used to call it leverage buyouts.
Yeah, it's not venture capital. It's private equity. Venture capital is a different animal altogether.
Venture capital is them changing their name to sound better. I could change my name to Kim Kardashian, but that doesn't make me rich.
Yeah.
And
well, these guys were already rich.
It doesn't make her a better person either. So,
right.
But, you know, I used to work for a community bank, and and they're no angels either. But at the time, someone would come in to do a private mortgage. And at the same time, with a house they hadn't paid off or anything yet, they also had the opportunity to set up a home equity line of credit based on that mortgage.
Right.
And that was supposed to be used for things like if the roof fell in or, you know, whatever.
Or if you want to put a new sink in or something.
Or something like that, yeah. Sometimes it could be as high as, if it was a $200,000 house, it could be as high as $50,000, depending on someone's income, things like that.
Right.
But when these venture capitalists or leverage buyouts happen, they kind of do the same thing. They're taking someone else's money that they're setting it up for themselves. And it's, to me, it looks like money laundering or credit laundering maybe is a better way to do it. They're taking,
yeah.
They're taking credit for one place and then moving that over and saying, see what we have?
Yeah, that's what these private equity firms are doing is credit laundering is a great phrase for it. That's brilliant, Cindy. Thank you very much. Well said. Absolutely brilliant. Charlie in Amarillo, Texas. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Tom, this what I was trying to explain to your interviewer there was that Boone Pickens started part of this leverage buyout stuff back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
A company in Amarillo called Pioneer Natural Gas. And then later on, he got involved with Bain Capital, and he tried to buy Phillips Petroleum on a hostile buyer.
Hostile takeover.
And then Bain Capital and Boone Pickens worked together for several years. Well, then Bain Capital turned against Boone Pickens and took his company away after he had bought the leverage buyout of Pioneer Natural Gas, and he named it Energas.
Hmm.
Then Bain Capital turned against Boone Pickens and leverage buyout hostile takeover of Energas and made it Atmos Energy now, which is a big conglomerate that has gas from North Dakota all the way to
Texas.
What's
your point, Charlie?
Well, Bain Capital is turned against its own creator, which was Boone Pickens.
Oh, I see. Okay. Or at least the creator of the genre, as it were. Yeah, okay. I got it. Thank you very much. And not just Boone Pickens. I mean, there were a bunch of these guys. Michael Milken. There were a bunch of these LBO artists, MMA guys, M&A guys. You know, and the whole LBO industry reinvented itself as private equity. Memorize that term, private equity. It is not venture capitalism. Venture capitalism is when you put capital into a new venture. Right. You say to Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, hey, you guys have got a great idea. Let me put $1 million into your company. I'll take 5% of the company in stock in exchange for that. Someday I'll sell that stock and make money. That's venture capital. Now, Bain has done some of that. In fact, the ad that Mitt Romney is running on TV right now is about a small steel company that Bain Capital was one of eight investors in, where they actually put money into the company. That's venture capital, and they occasionally did venture capital. But most of the big profits that they made were from private equity deals, leveraged buyouts. Levi in Syracuse, New York. Hey, Levi, what's up?
Hey, you know, I think you're exactly right. Bush, I'm a Republican, and Bush is a main cause of the debt and the deficit that we have right now. But I think you're being disingenuous to say that the tax cuts are in equating that to basically more spending, i.e. as if it was the government's money first and the government had the first right to that dollar, yeah, as opposed to...
Levi, in the abstract, spending. I understand what you're saying. I'm guessing that you've never actually looked at the numbers. There's some really great charts and graphs on this stuff that have been put together by a variety of groups, and they've been aggregated, over at the thinkprogress.org site. And if you just, for that matter, you could just search, you can Google and just say show images of the impact of the Bush tax cuts. If you look at from the time that Bush tax cuts went into effect until now, if you look at the entire federal debt right now, or the federal deficit, more than half of it is Bush tax cuts. About a third of it is two wars that were put on the credit card, and another 10 or 15% of it is Medicare Part D not being able to negotiate drug prices. Virtually all of today's deficit would not exist. This is the year-to-year deficit, would not exist if it wasn't for the Bush tax cuts, two wars, and Medicare Part D. Would not exist.
You know,
we would still have Bill Clinton's balanced budget.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm talking about phraseology. See, I'm an economist, and I'm also a policy analyst, and I've looked at it. I'm a government accountant. I understand exactly what you're referring to. What I don't like the premise, and I guess I disagree with the premise, that a tax cut actually cost the government money, in the sense that the government has first claim to that dollar. That's not the way it works.
Well, yes it is, because what we did by electing our elected representatives is we said, we're going to send you guys to Congress to act on our behalf. Those guys who went to Congress to act on our behalf said, okay, we're going to have this kind of military, we're going to have this kind of education system, we're going to have this kind of Medicare system, this kind of fill in the blanks, and bought those things. Taxes is where you come back and say, okay, it's been bought, now give me the money.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that is a moral obligation, and it is a post-action, arguably. It is a payment. It is legitimate.
We gotta fight the problems that be.
Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Harmon here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Walt in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Walt, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I thought I'd give you a quick example of a private equity deal that might make more sense. In the 1980s, I worked for a company in Bellevue here that the two owners decided to sell for tax planning purposes, and they found a businessman who would pay them $31 million for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he'd put $2 million down. So he put $2 million down and said, I owe $29 million for the company.
Right.
Well, as soon as he got the company, he said, well, actually, the company owes, and this is a retail company that had no debt and was very profitable.
Right.
So now the company owed $29 million on the debt that the businessman had actually signed for.
Right. Now it's become a private equity deal, like the way that Bain does it, under the new rules that Ronald Reagan brought us.
Yes. So actually, what he did do to get rid of the debt was he did a public offering and kept over 50% of the stock out of the public offering and paid off the company and became very wealthy after doing a public offering.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the company's still around.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Well, that's an example of playing the game and doing and having it work out. But I would submit to you that it wouldn't have been able to work out if he wasn't getting preferential tax treatment, for example, for the interest on the debt. If he wasn't able to associate that interest on that debt with the company's earnings so that the company could get a tax break, and if he wasn't able, to walk away with only paying a maximum 15% income tax on the revenue that he made from that deal. So basically, he was able to do that by gaming our tax code, which is what private equity depends upon.
Yeah, so he only ever shelled out $2 million, and he probably made about $100 million on the deal.
Yeah, and he didn't actually make $100 million. It's not like this guy, you know, made what did this company sell?
Groceries.
Okay, it wasn't like this guy grew $100 million worth of potatoes, right? He didn't actually make anything. He didn't manufacture the bags. He didn't stand in the checkout line and add up what people, you know, he didn't do anything that was productive for the company or for the economy. He gamed the system in a way that you and I pay more taxes, he pays less taxes, he walks away with $100 million. And that, you know, assuming that the way that you described the scenario was accurate. And that's the kind of thing that frankly, that's the financialization of our economy. This is the, and thank you for the call, Walt. This is Kevin Phillips wrote a book about this almost 20 years ago, and I think it was called Bad Money. I'm pretty sure that was the title of it. And it was about how, because of the changes that were made during the Reagan administration, our economy was moving away from a manufacturing model where people made money because they made things, or they built companies that made things, and they made a little profit off the top. And if they made too much profit off the top, somebody would come in and compete with them because, hey, there's profit to be made. And then the profit would become rational again. We moved away from an economy where people made things into an economy where people leveraged things, to use the phrase that an earlier caller made that was brilliant, where people are laundering credit. That's what's going on. And it's really startling. It's really startling. Erskine in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Erskine, what's up?
Yes. How you doing, Mr. Hartman? I appreciate you letting me get this question out. My question is concerning the Cory Booker issue.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I have probably a different perspective on it. I myself am an African American, and I think that him chastising the president was actually intentional, something that he chose to do on behalf of, like you say, the lobbyists and the people who actually are pulling the strings. I guess you said the Geppettos of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that my opinion is that it's a psychological tactic to actually weaken the president because he is the first black man in the history of the
United States. But Cory Booker's a black man.
I know. So what better way to use the tactic? It has no blowback if another African American diminishes the president.
See, this is
done every day. It's done every day in the media.
Oh yeah, you know, of course. I mean, Fox News has made a sport out of it.
CNN too. They are complicit in it. And I would say too also that I feel the president, he allows himself to be did this way. I don't know. Maybe it's a delusional rationale that he's humbling himself or something.
Well, he came out and he has pushed back on this. The president has. And Cory Booker is running all over everywhere right now saying, I didn't mean it. That's not what I meant. The Republicans are taking it out of context. I think that, you know, if he really intended to go in there and defend the banksters who had given money to his campaign, and by the way, they've given money to the campaigns of a lot of good progressives, black, white, anything in between or whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. I think that he would have at least stood with that position. I think that, frankly, what Cory Booker did was he came in with the media's line, which is, well, whatever the Republicans do that's nasty, the Democrats are doing something equally nasty, which is not true. It's the false equivalency. He had bought that hook, line, and sinker, and he recited that on television, the line that the David Gregorys of the world have been using for a long, long time now. And it actually is worse what the Republicans are doing than what the Democrats are doing. Going after Reverend Wright and trying to associate out of context a couple of sentences that he made in a speech, trying to associate that with the president of the United States is just wrong. I mean, it's morally wrong. It's ethically wrong. It's journalistically wrong. It's incorrect. It's factually wrong. It is wrong. On the other hand, to say, you know, Mitt Romney made his fortune gaming the tax code and laying people off is actually accurate. And that's where I think, A, Cory Booker probably doesn't know how private equity actually works. 99.999% of Americans don't understand how private equity works. They think that it's venture capitalism. They think it's simple investment. It's not. It's gaming the tax code, as I've been describing. And I don't think Cory Booker understood that, and although I'm guessing he's getting a quick education in it. And secondly, I think that he was just, you know, breathing the same air in that room with those Meet the Press people that, you know, oh, yeah, it's just this, you know, they both sides do it, and it's a terrible thing. Can you cut him some slack? No?
Mike, Erskine? Hello?
Yeah, you're still on.
Yeah, I say I actually, you know, I respectfully disagree because I think that he took those positions, like, under the guise that, like you say, that the financial backers, I think it's something that they put in his ear.
Yeah.
And I think the reason that he's retracting a lot of statements because he didn't feel that he would receive this type of blowback. You know, I mean, he was getting praised a few days ago for the quote-unquote bipartisan comedic commercial that him and the Governor Christie had. Mm-hmm. And more so than David Gregory, I would say that those are probably Governor Christie's precepts more so than Mr. Gregory for
that
him to get
sense.
On the TV show and say that. So I think he was aligning himself with those who have the same intentions that he has, but he didn't think he would receive the type of blowback. That's my opinion.
Do you think that his involving himself with Governor Christie, that this is an example of lay down with dogs, get up with fleas?
Not only that, I think is a shining example of how our political process on both sides have just been corrupted and have a delusional mind state. Because my opinion is, as a politician, what their job is, like you said earlier, that the people elect people that they feel have their interests right. at heart. And mm-hmm. a lot of these individuals, like you say, once they get into these positions, not only do they forget about the normal people, the regular people that need help in society, but they turn around and they, in my opinion, if you know someone needs help and you turn around and you do, not only do you not help them, but you intentionally hurt them, yeah. then that's a greater evil.
Well,
that's
I agree, but if you look at Cory Booker's record, he's done some amazing things.
No, I'm not talking about his record. I'm saying at the present moment what he chose to do.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because you can have ulterior motives to get into a position and be an opportunist when you see the opportunity arise, and that's what I equate with Cory Booker.
Yeah.
He saw opportunity to try to move across the lines to where he'll have a more standout image.
He was trying to be more
realize the blowback that he would get.
Yeah, he was trying to be more transpartisan, which I think is the same mistake that the president made in the first year that he was in office. He kept trying to reach across the aisle.
That's why I say he's also complicit in a lot of the attacks that he gets.
Yeah.
Because if he take a strong stance and be the type of person that he campaigned on, a lot of the blowback and a lot of the attacks that he get would not be effective as they are.
I agree, and that was the point that I said, you know, a lot of us wanted FDR and we got Bill Clinton, but even that is...
I agree with you on that one.
Yeah, but even that is better than getting Mitt Romney or George W. Bush or John McCain. I mean, you know, that you know, particularly with regard to the Supreme Court. Erskine, thank you very much for the call and for a very thoughtful analysis of this. Jonathan in Los Angeles, we've got a minute to the break. Jonathan, what's up?
Yes, I had 2 points. One was the idea that Republicans are fiscal conservatives and that they grow the economy. I heard Grover Norquist say that Reagan grew the economy, but I know that Nixon ran off a national debt that totaled the total national debt of all the presidents before him, including Roosevelt, who fought World War II and
right.
created the A-bomb.
Yeah, it wasn't Nixon who did that. It was Reagan who did that.
No, Nixon did it. I'm old enough to remember. I'm 69, and
okay.
I remember Nixon.
Okay.
And then Reagan followed by going Nixon better by creating a national debt greater than all the presidents before him. And then W did Reagan even better by growing the national debt more than all before him.
Okay.
And my second point has to do with what Elizabeth Warren talks about the infrastructure of the country, that all these corporations like Apple and Facebook and eBay and
they
Amazon,
all use our infrastructure. Yeah, no, I'm totally with you, Jonathan. Thank you. And they are intellectual infrastructure as well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Plus, you can drop into our live free chat room at TomHartman.com, where you can also get the updated version of our app, which has all our blogs and everything else on it. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. This Talk to Radio News Service report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Well, in addition to the European Union kinds of issues, the other issue that is really getting everybody focused is energy, and it is interesting that the former Lockheed CEO was before Congress today, and he was in front of energy, the Senate Energy Committee, and he said that investment in clean energy and research is absolutely a must. Then, of course, he was asked by the Republicans, represented by Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, for their recommendations on where they're going to fund this. And he talked about a modest tax on gasoline at the pump. And he said gas used to cost much less per gallon, but he said that there was money in those days that went through for research and development. Now, the president is going to be visiting an Iowa wind farm on Thursday, and it's interesting because I've been talking to my right-wing little friends in Iowa, and they tell me that they expect many trips from both the president and Romney because Iowa's up for grabs.
Right, and 20% of their electricity is now produced by those wind farms.
Right.
Which is amazing.
And the president is going to go to Newton, Iowa. He's going to visit TPI Composite. It is a wind energy manufacturing firm. And there is a total of 20,000 jobs, I think, directly, and then another 30,000 from parts down the line that are happening.
Wow. That is remarkable.
I mean, it's huge. And he also wants to... the president wants to extend the production tax credit, but of course the Republicans are trying to prevent everything this year from happening.
Right, because they want to crash the economy so that people will blame Obama for it.
Right, exactly. The House is out. They're just doing the pro forma. The Senate is in, and they are taking a look at the FDA law on manufacturing and drugs and medical devices. And what's interesting about that is both sides so desperately want to get home for Memorial Day that they're basically telling the president that they want to telling each other, only germane announcements will be allowed.
Is Memorial Day next weekend?
It's
a week, week from yesterday. I can't keep track of holidays. I'm hopeless. I don't do calendars. Okay, so the crunch is on. This is the last week.
The crunch is on, and they're telling their people, hey, look, we want to be home, and so both sides are doing some unseemly cooperation.
Oh, but what about Boehner's plan to hold, to crash the government over the debt ceiling? Or is that for the fall?
It's very interesting because, of course, it's the debt ceiling that he's freaking out about. But they know that they are not going to get those Bush tax cuts extended very readily because they don't have the votes in the Senate to do it.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
I mean, those tax cuts, they sunset. And then what are they going to do? Where are those 60 votes going to come from to extend them?
Yeah. Oh, because that was passed by
hard negotiating.
Were the original Bush tax cuts passed by reconciliation?
I don't honestly remember how they were passed. Although I think that
but they're time limited, so it seems like they must have been.
They were sunsetted. That's right.
Yeah, interesting.
And there was a suggestion at that point. This I do remember that all tax cuts and any revenue, one way or the other, be sunsetted.
Right. Fascinating. What else is it going
on? But, of course, we don't know about that.
By the way, how's Grenada?
Grenada is, it's amazing. It's warm, of course.
Yeah.
And And you know, it's interesting because you have a situation in the Caribbean where you've had extensive climate change and people don't really want to talk about it, but it's very hard with the destruction of the mangroves down here not to see what has happened there. And the other problem is, the drugs coming in through some of the Caribbean islands, not Grenada, fortunately, but through South America has made a very different kind of problem.
And some of the tropical diseases that are associated with that climate change, too, are starting to be problematic, aren't they?
Well, dengue fever, if you look at the map of dengue fever in the United States, it is extended. Even as you've heard about cases now, there were two cases in Miami last year or something.
Wow.
And that hadn't happened in 25, 30 years.
Yeah. That's incredible.
The other issue that I do want to talk about is the Senate banking and what is happening with the J.P. Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is, of course, that the head of the SEC said that had Dodd-Frank been in existence, they wouldn't have been in the trouble in terms of trying to get the information to what happened, et cetera. So, Dodd-Frank is something that people have been trying to really make happen, and had it happened, probably the J.P. Morgan thing wouldn't have happened in the way it did.
Wow. Because the regulators would have been able to look over their shoulders and say, hey, wait a minute, this is crazy.
Right, information.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Dodd-Frank is also about information.
Yeah, fascinating.
Basically, they said Dodd-Frank and Volcker rule would have, the Republicans are saying that those restrictions are too tight, and other people are saying you wouldn't have probably had this $2 billion loss.
Right. Now it's up to three, in fact. The last minute we have left here, what else is going on in the world?
Okay. I just wanted to ask you whether you were going to be a bidder on Reagan's blood.
No. I am very, very concerned that somebody by the name of Frankenstein might be bidding on that. In any case.
Can you imagine? That's one thing. Also, we reported this morning, it was an NBC Wall Street poll, 62% say the president's support for gay marriage does not make a difference in their votes, and that includes 75% of independents. And also, just because it's hit all the Washington news, Cousin Josh this is Ohio, he's running against Sherrod Brown, is being examined by the federal government, by the Justice Department, because there's one company that had a lot of its employees donating to his campaign. And those donations, Tom, came from people who had never given to a federal campaign, and they maxed out in their donations. And
amazing.
It was totally illegal to pay somebody back, so the feds are investigating.
Amazing. This Talk Radio News report brought to you by the German Embassy, germany.info.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Mike Riggs with the Reason Foundation, Reason.com, Associate Editor of Reason Magazine, too, on the line with us. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. There's two things on my mind. Number one is this, you guys are talking about ending the federal crackdown on medical marijuana. I think it's one of the few areas where I agree with libertarians.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'd say it's one of them.
So,
definitely.
So you know, what's your take on where this is going and what we should do about it?
I think where this is going, I mean, last week there was a poll that came out that for the first time there's a majority of Americans think that Obama should end the crackdown on medical marijuana raids. I think we may have seen this sooner if this was something pollsters actually cared about. But there's that. There's the fact that he promised when he was campaigning in 2008 to sort of stop the crackdowns, which were a signature issue under George W. Bush. There's the fact that in 2004 he said that he thought that marijuana should be decriminalized. So the two things you sort of really have going here is public opinion says, you know, this stuff is fine. People should be allowed to use it, especially in states that have legalized it. And then on the other hand, you have Obama who said that he'd stop cracking down. I mean, there are other issues, too. There's the law enforcement questions. There's the science behind using marijuana as a treatment for pain and a better alternative to prescription pharmaceuticals. But the two big ones, I would say, are the politics of it, which is that people think it should be that states should have legalized that people should be able to do it, and Obama already said he would stop cracking down.
Right, and so it's time for him to keep his word. I am totally with you on this. I think, frankly, personally, I think that he cracked open the political world by endorsing marriage equality, and I think if he were to endorse at the very least a total rollback of federal laws that prevent states from administering their own marijuana laws, particularly with regard to medical marijuana, I think he would create another one of those giant cracks among the independent and weak Republican constituency that is largely libertarian leaning. I think that this could actually be the thing that pushes him over the top. The hard right guys in the base who are already running around, you know, screaming that, you know, Obama wants, gay marriage on every street corner or something, they will then start screaming, now he wants, you know, people smoking dope on every corner. So what? Those people are going to be crazy no matter what. He's never going to get them no matter what. But I think that rational or semi-rational conservatives, libertarians, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think, there's a growing list of issues on which Romney and Obama are sort of indistinguishable. I think some of those are going to be kind of difficult to create any daylight, but marijuana is a really easy one. Obama doesn't have to do anything. All he has to do is stop doing something that's expensive. I mean, these are hard fiscal times, so he can just say in the 16 states in the District of Columbia where medical marijuana is legal, let's stop cracking down. It's really that simple. It creates a huge amount of daylight between him and Mitt Romney. And the other problem, I think, with his and Romney's similarities on this issue is that they both sort of handled it the same way, which is they've sort of turned it into a joke. I mean, Romney, there's this sort of internet famous video of a person in a wheelchair who I think has some form of palsy saying to Romney, you know, like, I suffer chronic pain. Do you think I should be allowed to use marijuana? And Romney just looks at the guy and like sort of chuckles and says no and then walks away.
Right. He actually kind of treated the guy like the guy had just said, I have tuberculosis and I'm about to sneeze.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, basically, Romney treated him like,
like a leper.
The most horrible thing he'd ever been faced with. Right, yeah. And Obama has an equally bad habit of sort of just shrugging this off when he's approached with it. I mean, he's been asked several times since he was elected, like, what about this promise you made? And I think when he's been asked that question publicly, like at the YouTube Q&A sessions that he occasionally does, he's laughed. And when he's had the conversations behind closed doors with journalists, more intimate settings, he's come up with these sort of bogus things saying, oh, I never said I'd allow medical marijuana. I simply said we wouldn't be locking up cancer patients. There are still raids on individual homes done in states where marijuana is legal on patients. There are definitely raids on dispensaries. And so what if Obama is not locking them up? He's still keeping these people from getting access to their medicine and forcing them to go the much more expensive and much more sort of, a less holistic path of taking heavy-duty prescription pharmaceuticals.
Right. I'm totally with you. Mike, question, as a libertarian, I'm assuming you self-identify as a libertarian.
When I'm forced to identify something, it's that. Yeah.
Okay, here's the question. Capitalism creates winners and losers. Libertarians generally, if you ask libertarians which is more important, democracy or capitalism, their answer would be capitalism because it facilitates democracy. Am I right?
Yeah, the idea is that
the second knock-on from that, or the second step-on from that, is capitalism, by its very nature, creates winners and losers. What would libertarians do with, for, or about the losers?
With, for, or about the losers. So, I mean, the sort of libertarianism I identify with, and I think most of the people I sort of consort with, is this idea that we should have a basic safety net. I mean, you can look at a lot of libertarianism.
But that's not libertarianism.
You know what? I mean,
that's Eisenhower Republicanism.
I think the shrinking the size of the safety net is, you know, probably a good idea. I mean, we
why?
Why? Because
I mean, have you ever tried living on $3 a day for as your entire food budget?
I think the problem with the safety net, Tom, is that it, just like every other government program, it experiences mission creep. I mean, one of the reasons the war on drugs is so large right now is because having a job as a police officer is now...
The war on drugs is not the safety net. That's not what we're talking about.
The war on drugs is a part of the welfare program.
I'm not talking about the war on drugs. You know, I'm with you on that, but there, and it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. There's not a multi-billion-dollar industry that has grown up around people being on food stamps. And food stamps are you know, basically, it's $3 a day. And you got, you know, 44 million people who literally have to have this in order to eat. And on $3 a day, all you can buy is crap food. And it's like, and you want to dial that back. And I don't understand why.
No. I've said on your show before that I think that actual welfare for poor people, I'm fine with that. I have a problem with corporate welfare. I have a problem with corporatism. I have a problem with the amount of money we spend.
Well, then if you're fine with it, you're not a libertarian. Because Ron Paul would put an end to all of it.
That's simply not true. I mean, to say that Ron Paul is the only kind of Democrat, the only kind of libertarian.
Well, the Libertarian Party would put an end to all of it. That's the official position of the Libertarian Party, is that the only role for government is to enforce laws against fraud and to have an army and police force.
I understand what the platforms are. I get it. I get what you're saying. But I also think to say that there's only one type of libertarian or one type of libertarianism is to point to people like John Corzine and say he's the only type of liberal and the only type of Democrat, that Cory Booker is the only type of liberal, the only type of Democrat. And I know that you would feel uncomfortable with that, and that your readers and your listeners and your audiences would feel uncomfortable with that.
But I think there's some basic litmus test issues, and one of them is the role of government. You know, what roles government should play. It really sounds to me, like, Mike, that you're taking the position that the Republican Party did before it got hijacked by the Reagan administration, by the crazies.
I have no problem with having a small safety net. I absolutely have no problem with that. I just think, I mean, one of the concerns that I know the libertarians want no safety net, one of the concerns that they have and that I think is a real one, is that the more things that you give the government to do, the more things it's going to say it needs to do. Okay. So I understand
Mike,
that.
Mike Riggs, Mike, we're out of time. Reason.com. Thank you, Mike.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating conversation. What should we do with the losers of capitalism?
One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance! To Dwayne in Portland. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Tom, I have a little bit of a sideline on private capital. I worked for an optical wholesale lab that was a mom and pop organization up until 2000 for like 40 years, and then it was bought by a private capital corporation, bundled with 14 other labs, and sold to the Japanese.
Hmm.
Now, what I find interesting is that on the downside, we did lose a little because the original owners were more generous, but on the upside, we kept our jobs, and we've over the years held on to what we had better than a lot of people that work for American companies.
Right. I would submit to you that what you experienced was not the ravages of private equity. What you experienced was simply a mergers and acquisitions deal.
Those tend to be less destructive. They're not going to anybody in this country. They're going to Japan.
Right. All the profits are now going offshore.
And I think that's a point that a lot of people forget. I mean, like my whole industry was bought out by basically three different companies: France, Germany, and Japan. Japan.
Yeah.
And so that was an industry that was specific to this country until that merger and acquisition thing started to happen back in the early part of the century.
Yep.
And I think that's something that also is another side issue along with this whole thing of what private capital and venture capital does.
You mean private equity?
Private equity, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I don't disagree. And you had a question about optimism?
Well, yeah, you know, the thing that drives me nuts is that, like, I've been listening to you since you were here in Portland, since you started, and I know all the talking points. What I'm looking for is a positive narrative to counter all the negativity that comes with understanding what's really going on, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And maybe that's asking for too much, but I mean, like, I listen to you 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and It sometimes gets a little bit tough, short of just turning you off and walking away from it, to deal with all the issues that are coming at me that I understand so clearly because of the good work that you're doing.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes I this morning I was walking down to the train station, and I was Louise didn't come in with me today. She had a minor medical procedure yesterday, and which is why I was off. And she stayed home today, and our daughter's coming to visit because she starts chemo on Thursday. And so I was walking alone down to the train station, and usually when I'm walking alone, that's when I say my prayers. And I don't want to turn this into a, you know, Bible moment, but, you know, so I was walking along. I was just saying prayers and it suddenly hit me. I should say a prayer for the Koch brothers, that they would, you know, understand the impact of what they're doing on others. And but you know, I'm not a big advocate of petitionary prayer, like, please God do this, because I think it's incredibly presumptuous. So I just basically said a prayer for the Koch brothers, you know, because they have so much impact. They're changing all of our lives. I think that we are up against some really, really powerful forces. We being the working people of the United States, the you know, average Americans, people who are not and were not born into the 0.1%. And it is a challenge of generational proportions. I also know that if you look at the cycles of history, every 80 years, there is a crash, typically followed by a war, followed by a reformation. 80 years ago from now, it was the Great Depression. 80 years before that, it was the Civil War. 80 years before that, and the Great Depression of 1857 that led to the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the Depression of 1773 that led to the Boston Tea Party and led to the Revolutionary War. 80 years before that, and in the 1690s, there was another crash. The War of the Roses was back there in that 80-year cycles. And I think it's basically about how long it takes for the last person to die off who remembers the stupidity that brought us the last crash and could warn about it. And then we have to learn our lessons the hard way. And I think we're in the process right now of learning our lessons the hard way. And the more of us who are out there telling the truth, and the more of us who are out there, you know, saying a prayer is not your path, whatever it may be, but who are out there, you know, trying to bring about real change and making an effort and holding a positive vision for this country, I think, you know, I'm not despairing about the situation. I don't know giving you any consolation here, Duane.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, like, it's also nice having Carl out here in Portland.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Carl Wilson is
he's really helpful.
Brilliant.
And I've had a couple of contacts with him. In fact, I gave you a card when you spoke at Powell's when you were selling Cracking the Cold years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the guy that was the fanatic about the arts locally in Portland.
Yeah.
And since you've left, it's coming to light that Portland may be the new art capital of America. So.
Yeah, well, one of the things that Portland has, and this is the thing, people, you know, when things get really rough, people start looking for models. And Portland is probably the most heavily planned city in America. Very, very intense urban planning. And the consequence of that is, and from living there, I lived there 5 years, is that the quality of life in Portland is probably better than most any city in the United States. There's green space everywhere. You know, this whole thing of mixed use. You know, if you're going to build an apartment building, you have to be able to walk to stores. You have to have a certain amount of commercial space and retail space and, you know, all these. I mean, it's very well thought out and it works. So
Yeah, we all miss you out here in Portland.
Yeah, well, thank you, Duane. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good
you.
To hear from you. But, you know, my point is that I think that, that there are these beacons of light. There are these models, for lack of a better word, these examples of where it works. And then there's models of where it doesn't work. You know, you like the entire state of Texas. People look at that and go, oh, no, don't think so. I think people are waking up. I really do.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And people waking up makes me very optimistic. We'll be back with more of your thoughts right after this. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very mastigophoriciously ugly. The good. Clean Star Mozambique. The venture formed by the companies Clean Star Ventures and Novozymes is a biofuels operation in Mozambique that seeks to support local farmers, prevent deforestation, and provide a cleaner burning fuel for local residents. Many residents of Mozambique use biomass-based cook stoves, which contribute to deforestation in that country, accelerate short-term global warming, and cause many respiratory illnesses every year. Since the support for biofuels as an alternative energy source isn't gaining ground in developed countries like the U.S., companies like Clean Star and Novozymes are targeting smaller countries. A small country like Mozambique can embrace climate change and alternative energy? Hey, so can the United States. The bad. The Iowa Republican Party. The Iowa Republican Party released its official party platform on Monday, and it's filled with far-reaching Tea Party-approved policy ideas. For starters, birtherism is an official stance of the party, and the party argues that a candidate for president must provide proof of U.S. citizenship. The party also wants to eliminate basically every government department and believes that under the 10th Amendment, any state can disregard federal law if they think in their own extraordinary wisdom that that law is unconstitutional. And the party also, this is the Republican Party, and I also officially believes in the conspiracy theory that the United Nations is trying to take over total control of the world. It's too bad the party platform doesn't talk about real issues, like fixing our economy or protecting the environment. And the very, very ugly Pastor Charles Worley. The North Carolina so-called pastor gave a sermon this weekend to his congregation discussing how he thinks Americans should deal with gay men and lesbians. After saying the thought of men kissing makes him puking sick, Worley said that America should build a giant fenced-in pen, put all the country's gays in it, electrify the pen so they can't get out, and drop food into it. Worley said it this way. In a few years, they'll die out, he said. You know why? They can't reproduce. Pastor Worley's comments, his incredible bigotry, and his endorsement of Nazi-like actions are at the very least very, very, very ugly. Amazingly ugly. Just amazingly ugly. Rob in Nogales, Arizona. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind today?
Hey, this is Rob.
Yeah, if you're on a speakerphone, Rob, if you could pick up the phone, I'd appreciate it.
Today finds you doing well?
It does, thank you. And I hope the same is true of you.
Well, I kind of wanted to bring a topic concerning banking and capitalism and Main Street people like myself that maybe following listeners could comment on and maybe elaborate on it.
Okay.
You know, our parents, I'm about the same age as you, and our parents had a model for saving for retirement, 401ks and that sort of thing.
Actually, 401ks came along before my dad. I mean, after 401ks came along, you know, with the Reagan administration.
Well, right, I do understand that, but savings plans similar to that have been around, and after so many years, it starts growing, and then after
sure.
20 years, it grows really big, and by the time you got 30 years of socking a little bit away, you're supposed to be able to retire comfortably.
Right.
and pretty much our parents had that opportunity for the most part.
Plus, typically by 30 years, they'd paid off their houses, which was the principal equity of most Americans.
Correct. But anyway, so I'm one of the lucky Americans. I do still have my house, but I've been saving since 1982. Mm-hmm. So how many years is that? 40?
Enough. Yeah, 30. nearly 30 years. Or it is 30 years.
And so I put in myself, my contribution was $80,000 over this 30-year period.
Mm-hmm.
And today it's worth $102,000.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gained, $22,000 over a 30-year period, which is nothing.
Mm-hmm. And inflation it's probably just basically kept up with inflation, if that.
Yeah, if that. And so, and I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm not downtrodden completely. But this is what's happening to all these, workers that, only earned $25,000 to $50,000 over the last 30 years.
Yeah, well, and the median income in the United States right now is $26,200 a year. So people making that amount of money, even if they're not trying to support a family, people making that kind of money have a hard time setting aside anything, much less buy a house or anything else.
That is true. And like one of the lucky ones, but it didn't work out for me either.
How so?
Not really. Because what do we have, a downturn in the late 80s, in 98,
right.
2002, again in 08.
Right.
I may have the dates wrong, but
no.
How frustrating is that to all these, the rest of the 99% that have been trying to do it the right way?
Right. Well, this is the problem, is that this was sold to us as the right way, in quotes, and particularly Reagan, his strategy for privatizing Social Security was first get people into individual investment plans and use the tax code to encourage that. First it was IRAs and individual retirement accounts, then the SEP IRAs, and then these all kinds of other fancy instruments, and then they came up with the 401k variation of the tax code that allowed people to set money aside but locked them in. That said, if you took money out of this before retirement, you got hit with a huge penalty, blah-de-blah, quack, quack, quack. And when that came along, that was the point. I've got right now about $6,200 in an IRA that I opened probably 15 years ago and put $1,000 into. And when the 401s came along, and my recollection is that it was in the 80s, I could be wrong, but I remember when they came along thinking, okay, this is the beginning of a giant scam. This is their way of trying to get people to think that, the private market is an alternative to Social Security and do away with Social Security, and trying to lock you into a relationship with a bank because somebody has to administer it. You can't administer it yourself. And so I've never had a 401k or any other kind of retirement account. Now, that's probably bad economic planning on my part. My CPA probably thinks I'm nuts. I've never asked him, but who knows. But it has always struck me as bad public policy. So anyhow, you're responding to the question that I asked Mike about capitalism creates winners and losers. What are we going to do with, for, or about the losers? Is that your response?
Yeah, I'm one of the losers.
Yeah. Well, and amazingly, I mean, the average American family right now has $75,000 worth of debt. You've got, assets in your home, plus you've got over $100,000. So you're like, you're in the top 5% of wealth in the United States, which is pretty shocking when you think about it, because you've got enough money that, if you retire, you might, you could burn through that in 2 or 3 years. And if you got sick, you could burn through it in 2 or 3 weeks. And,
that's right.
And that's just, it shouldn't be that way in this country. We're the richest country in the world. It just shouldn't be that way. So anyway, thank you very much for the call, Rob. Great to hear from you. Lee in Trumansburg, New York. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Well, I had the same experience as the last guy. However, I wanted to comment on the losers. I know where they are.
Okay.
They are con men and charlatans, and they work in Washington, D.C., And isn't there anybody there that can run them out of town on a rail with tar and feathers?
Well, the problem is the Supreme Court has said that what they're doing is just fine. Thank you very much. And by the way, please give a little more money to Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, there you go. But also, a great starting point. Lee, thank you for the call. It's very interesting. Eric in Gainesville, Florida. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you're a great American, and I just want to ask you, is it true that the people in Greece could have overcame their austerity measures had they just taxed the rich?
By and large, yes. Greece has a culture of the very wealthy evading their taxes and moving their money offshore, and so there are a lot of people in Greece who are very wealthy who don't pay anything in taxes. And they're moving their money offshore really, really aggressively right now, which is probably going to crash Greece even faster. So, yeah, it's a piece of it. Part of it also is what happened with Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs helped them lie about their debt and get them into the euro. They shouldn't have been in the euro to begin with. They were not strong enough economically to put their entire economy in the hands of the European Central Bankers. And their debt to GDP ratio was too high. So Goldman Sachs came in and said, we'll buy your debt and we'll issue you an instrument whereby you owe that money to us, but we won't call it a debt. We'll call it a credit default swap or something like that, some kind of a swap. And so this is something that's not covered in the rules for the EU. So technically, you still have this debt, and you have this debt to Goldman Sachs and other banks associated with them, but it doesn't show up on your balance sheet, so the EU has to let you in. And this was a scam that Goldman Sachs put together that got Greece into the EU. And as long as things were good, as long as the economy was growing, as long as the real estate bubble was continuing to expand in Greece and everywhere else in Europe, no problem. But the minute things went bad, Greece couldn't cover that. And, you know, and they had faked it, right? They'd basically taken out a liar loan. And they had done it with the complicity of, you know, one of the biggest banks in the world, Goldman Sachs. So now they're where they are. I think what they should do is create the drachma now, start using it as a domestic currency, stay in the EU as long as they can, continue using the euro for international settlements, and transition to the drachma.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But then what do I know? On the other hand, I think the new Prime Minister of Greece agrees with me. We'll see. Time will tell. Well, one can hope. I think, you know, we've got an oligarchy right now, but I think it's slowly changing. Gary in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yep. Well, you know, I talked to you last week about how the system was, you know, the rich controlling, and it's an evolutionary process. But I also wanted to make a point, because I was near the end of the day, I didn't make it to the end, is that the amount of wealth that is out there, I don't think the American public is aware of the wealth that is out there. Microsoft money in the sand is sitting on $5-10 billion. The amount of wealth out there is astounding.
Yeah.
One investor group owns 6 restaurant chains, and each chain has hundreds, if not thousands, of restaurants. These investor groups have hundreds of billions of dollars. The amount of wealth that are out there is astounding, and it's going to be very, very difficult to have justice with that kind of wealth. I'm not anti-rich, but people have to understand what we're dealing with now. You know, the last 30 years, the amount of wealth that's been established, I don't think the world has ever seen this kind of wealth ever before.
You know, relatively speaking, I think perhaps we have, and in fact, according to the statistics, the last time we saw this level of wealth inequality was the year 1929, which is why I think that we're on the edge of 1929 all over again.
It was so time there wasn't that kind of money out there. And I'm talking about hundreds of billions
sure.
of dollars involved, investor groups, several,
yeah.
but maybe more
this
than
is, this is
having
right.
hundreds of billions of dollars to their fingertips. That wasn't available back then. You didn't have that kind of wealth. Of course,
well,
in reality, the money was at a lower level.
Yeah, I would say you have to adjust for inflation when you start using numbers. But I think that, I honestly don't know. But the point is that what we're seeing, and Gary, thank you for the call. Well, point well made. Let me just share with you our quote for the day, which will be in our newsletter, and Sean picked this out. It's just great. This is from Thomas Jefferson. There is an artificial aristocracy founded on wealth and birth without either virtue or talents. The artificial aristocracy is a mischievous ingredient in government, and provisions should be made to prevent its ascendancy. Thomas Jefferson. I mean, you know, it doesn't get much better than that. It's really quite remarkable. Ralph in Westchester, New York. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Hi. Oh, I like that quote. That reminds me of something Al Franken always says about the inheritance tax and the wealthy, and how we want to reward the most productive people in society, the children of the very rich.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk more about the losers of society and what is to become of them. And basically, if you shred the social safety net, you don't have Social Security, and you don't have welfare, then basically what you're left with is a whole class of people that become indentured servants, serfs, and concubines, basically, just like unpaid interns. I mean, the society is trying to move in that direction. This is what corporations want, is cheap labor.
Yeah, and there are entire websites devoted to young women who want to marry rich men. There are, I mean, you know, increasingly, the stratification of society is increasing, the aggregation of power in fewer hands, more and more wealth and the power that's associated with it is growing. When the median income in the United States, or the mean income in the United States, is $26,200 a year, you know that there are a lot of people in this country who are in a lot of economic pain and desperation. And that, in my opinion, drops them into the category of indentured servants or something close to it, serfs. I totally agree with you. And, you know, very, very well said. Carla in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Carla, what's up?
Hi there. I want to know why, if corporations are people, why we can't bring them up on charges of human abuse and human rights charges. You know, today they came out with the sentencing of that man that videotaped his gay roommate having sex, and then the poor young man.
He wasn't even having sex. He was just having a romance. But yeah,
a romance. And so he committed suicide. He was so embarrassed.
Yeah,
but I just saw on your thing about Wells Fargo about how they harassed these couples for a couple of years, and the man finally killed himself. So the wife was without her husband, without her home. And why isn't this in the news? And why can't we get Wells Fargo with criminal charges? If these people are now people, if these corporations are now people, they have got to take responsibility for what they are doing to us and our lives.
Yeah. What you are speaking to, Carla, in addition to the insanity of the Supreme Court doctrine that money is not property, it's speech, and that corporations are not legal abstractions, they're people, is the core notion that we need to be rethinking our corporate charter laws. Right now, we give corporations way too much insulation and people in corporations, and it didn't used to be that way. Throughout the 18th century and the 19th century in the United States, right up until the 1890s, directors of corporations and even shareholders in corporations could be held personally and criminally responsible for misbehavior by the corporation and the officers of the corporations as well, and representatives and lawyers and lobbyists and everything. And then in the 1890s, largely in response to John Rockefeller, we had this charter mongering era where the states got into a competition to see who could drop the standards and make, you know, corporations more and more insulated from these things. And it didn't help this nation. It wasn't a good thing for this nation. So, you know, I'm with you. We need to change our corporate charter laws and bring back corporate responsibility. But, you know, they've got very, very deep claws into our system. The other thing we need to do is establish, and what used to be here is essentially a corporate estate tax. It used to be, up until the 1880s, that no corporation in America could exist for more than 40 years. And we need to go back to that, too. Anyhow, Carla, thank you for the call. Well said. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, tomorrow we'll have a rumble with David Harsanyi of Human Events Online about the J.P. Morgan debacle and why we need more regulation. Plus, with Ron Paul all but out of the race for president, what's next for libertarians? They're going to hold their noses and rally for Romney? And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.